Welcome to Health Center in the Catskills on WIOX Radio. I'm Diana Mason, the host of this program, where we focus on the impact of local, state, national, and global issues on the health of the individuals, families, and communities in the Central Catskill regions. If you're a regular listener to this program, you know that we've talked a lot here about end-of-life issues. I feel very strongly about this. We need to have these conversations. So if you've tuned in, you know that I am this huge proponent of everyone having an advance directive in which you indicate someone who will serve as your healthcare proxy, making decisions for you about your end-of-life care if you can no longer, or about your care, if you can no longer make decisions for yourself. Well, to do so, it's crucial that you have regular conversations with your loved ones and your proxy about your wishes. Maybe it is because I'm a nurse and I've seen so many people die, both good deaths and horrible deaths. And I know what a difference these discussions can make. Well, I'm not alone in wanting people to have these discussions. Mary Ellen Mercant is another nurse who talks a lot about preparing for death. She writes and talks to groups about how to begin to feel comfortable with and accept death as a natural part of living. And I am delighted to have Mary Ellen Mercant on Health Center in the Catskills today. Thank you so much for joining me, Mary Ellen.
Oh, it's a pleasure to connect with you.
So we are both nurses, and I did reflect on, is there something about being a nurse that it puts us in the position of wanting to have these conversations?
Well, I think so, because during the course of our original programs in nursing education, presumably we both learned about developmental phases of the human life cycle, including aging and decline. Compared to when I was in college studying nursing, nowadays there's a tsunami of material to advance death education and to guide people preparing for the end of life. Whether it relates to the dying journeys of terminally ill individuals, hospice care, post-death management, bereavement support, or so many other aspects, the domain encompasses both physical and psychological applications, which are the threads in the tapestry of nurses' functions. Death is a part of life, and though it's the last part, it's often a neglected matter, and it certainly warrants understanding and a willingness, and I think even a responsibility on the part of nurses, to talk about it within the context of varying capacities or roles. Both you and I use our respective aptitudes and channels for doing that.
So, Mary Ellen Mercant, I learned about you through a friend and colleague, a nurse colleague, who has relocated from New York City to up in Rochester, New York, and is in an independent living facility for older people. And right. You spoke there, and she said how wonderful you were, and that your focus was on thinking about funerals and preparing for what we want to have happen after we die. So you've really gone farther than me. I have not addressed that topic yet. Why is this topic so important?
Well, I think it relates to family health and well-being. I fully understand the prevalent societal yuck factor when it comes to anything funerary. Generally, people don't want to die, and we can't imagine not being here. And yet, we can't escape the fact that it will happen. And when it does, most likely our families and beloved companions are going to be stricken by distress, possibly overwhelmingly so, and sometimes even to the point of functional incapacitation. But our death-dodging mentality doesn't allow us to take the next step and acknowledge the inevitable impact on our loved ones because we're so intent on avoiding the topic altogether. We don't want our life companions to suffer when we die, but they will. And the suffering will be worse for them if we don't address death prep ahead of time. Yeah. And that entails contemplation of funerary options and selections, though not necessarily making preliminary arrangements. Simply declaring and documenting one's wishes or intentions can provide major stress relief and promote well-being. I always, when I give presentations, I like to think of this as a gift. And sometimes I even take a wrap box with documents in it or music, CDs that people would like to use. It's a collection box. And if you see it with a bow on top, you can think of it as a gift. I think preparing and communicating funerary preferences can be a tremendously valuable and subsequently treasured gift to bestow upon your loved one. Because think of the state of disorientation and upheaval.
Yeah.
If they have that, they'll have a sense of direction.
Yes.
And they'll have a course of action already plotted out to follow. And like you mentioned, I have had many contacts with individuals in the context of discussion groups. And I've heard the real life stories of what a difference such forethought can make. People who have been tasked with orchestrating funerary arrangements have expressed such extreme gratitude when they've had a blueprint to follow. And on the other hand, like you, I've heard from so many folks whose anguish was intensified by not knowing what to do or what the person would have wanted, feeling absolutely clueless because the subject had never been broached. So I really believe, regardless of age, that becoming informed about funerary options and issues and determining preferences and communicating them is a way to advance one's own mental health as well as that of loved ones. And the thing that's surprising is it can be enjoyable and even fun.
Well, that's an interesting take on it. I wasn't going to go that far, but I just want to comment on what a difference it does make. My own husband died about a year and a half ago. I knew his wishes. I knew he wanted to be cremated. I know what he wants to have happen to his ashes. I haven't done it yet. But also what made a huge difference was, the woman is a nurse, Elaine Faulkner, who works at Miller Funeral Home. I didn't know she was a nurse at the time, but she was so spectacular in when I came to meet with her and to make arrangements, because his body was down in an hour and a half from where we live. So she was absolutely extraordinary. And I think that makes a huge difference. But if I'd never had the conversation with my husband, it would have been all the harder. So I think you're onto something. And I really do like the idea of the gift box. I actually feel like because I knew my husband's wishes for what he wanted and didn't want, even when he was alive, that I gave him the gift of dying the good death. And I will always hold on to that.
And you have the enduring feelings of satisfaction as
absolutely
a result.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So one of the things my friend who lives in upstate New York told me about, she was looking to arrange a green burial. She actually wanted to be composted, and you can tell us about that. But she did find a place in Rochester where she's going to have a green burial, and it's in a cemetery that has a field where birds come, and there are bird houses there that they have. So she felt like she just liked the idea of having a bird on top of her and just, you know, living its life. So tell us about green, because we don't have these that I know of yet in our region. So tell us about a green burial and human composting.
Okay, well, I can tell you also that I think you do have them within the realm of New York State and where it's reachable for you. But
Where's that?
Well, let's see. I came across one off the thruway in Fultonville, a lovely little regular cemetery, but it's called hybrid when they also have a section for green burials.
Ah.
And that's in Fultonville. But they also have a couple, I think, in Schenectady and then Albany, Troy, let's see. Oh, across the river in Sleepy Hollow and Rhinebeck.
Yeah.
I don't know if they're within reach.
Those are more than an hour away from us. Yeah.
If anyone were interested, it is legal to take a body and transport the body yourself to a cemetery as long as a funeral director is at the other end to oversee the disposition, and as long as the person has a burial permit. But anyway, that's kind of extraneous. We should really address the matter of what is a green burial. Anything, of course, that's dubbed green is ecologically prudent or conducive to earthly sustenance. It's good for the environment. But we're able to have our spent bodies buried or reduced now without imposing pollution or unnecessary clutter. So a green or natural burial entails a process based on earth-friendly principles. Instead of trying to inhibit the process of decomposition, it promotes it, enabling us to give our bodies back to Mother Nature. Through the years since the Civil War, as you know, with the introduction of embalming, along with funeral home involvement, industrial-strength funerals have been the norm, complete with all sorts of manufactured merchandise.
Yeah.
So I have slideshows with pictures of this, but it's easy for me to imagine, but just imagine what the underground territory of a typical cemetery looks like. Closely situated headstones hint at the manufactured chaos beneath the surface, the speaking conspicuous consumption of trappings that have rendered unseen junkyard effects. So there's this engorged subterranean landscape of foreign objects in the form of caskets and bolts and metal hardware, etc. And then there are the chemicals that are used in the manufacture of products and the toxic formaldehyde used for embalming. So these are man-made affronts to the environment that linger for many years. Green burials offer an alternative to this type of contamination. So biodegradability is a key principle inherent in green burials. A body is buried either in an organic wrap or a receptacle that will readily break down, having not been embalmed unless recently available biodegradable fluids were used. Instead of a burial depth of about 6 feet, it's more likely 3.5 to 4 feet, which positions the body in soil that's richly endowed with a dynamic living ecosystem. An industrious community of microbes and nematodes and insects resides there, ready to break down the human tissue and convert it into usable elements amid fertile soil that will nourish subsequent vegetation. So, and instead of a substantial memorial marker, there's a field stone or something very small to identify the decedent. And then flora native to the area may be the only permissible vegetation. The grounds are free of pesticides and other chemicals. They're not groomed, or they're not maintained in the usual manner. So a natural habitat like for other life forms, like you mentioned with the birds. Actually, the birds, they have the bird houses at this cemetery you mentioned, and they're above a field of wildflowers.
Yes.
And they give the guests wildflower seeds to toss, and so that they perpetuate the growth of the wildflowers after the burial.
So I did find out from Elaine Faulkner for local people here that the Roxbury Cemetery will bury an unembalmed body.
Yeah.
One that's not embalmed in a wood box or casket, but they still must have a vault, some type of vault. Which seems to be sort of ridiculous. I think it's probably related to New York City watershed rules, perhaps?
I don't know what it relates to, but why? Why would they require that in one cemetery and not another where they do allow the natural burials?
Yeah.
I don't understand the disparity there.
Yeah. And what's the difference between that then and human composting?
Well, human composting is a relatively new concept. It's just been developed in the last few years. It's actually known as natural organic reduction, and sometimes you see in literature NOR. It simulates natural or green burials, but in an above-ground, more controlled environment. At a specialized facility for this purpose, an unembalmed body situated in a wooden or metal container is nestled between organic additives, such as wood chips, straw, alfalfa, and sawdust. And then in the presence of appropriate amounts of carbon and nitrogen, naturally occurring microbes, namely bacteria, protozoa, and fungi, go to work while proliferating, fueled by invigorating oxygen coupled with heat that's generated, and with the help of periodic rotations for aeration, the microbes decompose the body, reducing it to molecular elements within just a few weeks, followed by a period for curing. The result is a major metamorphosis of bodily substance into a substantial amount of fertile soil. And I don't mean just a little packet. I mean really maybe a truckload or several bags full. And the family can take whatever amount they wish to use for their own purposes or to share with others to plant something. Or they can donate it for restoration of land in certain designated forests. So it's really an exciting concept. And surprisingly, New York actually passed legislation approving it at the end of December, the last day of December in 2022. So right now, people have to transport bodies to Washington State or Colorado. But before long, we may see some facilities being established here in New York.
Great, great. So I want to talk about, get two other topics in here. One is just your advice to people about planning their deaths and doing these funeral arrangements. What advice do you give them? What are the three most important points that you want people to take away about planning for their deaths?
I don't know if I have three most important points, but I think my advice is a little bit different than the typical advice, because I would like people to think of it when they're alive and well and healthy, not when they're dealing with bereavement or in a terminal situation, but I would like them to think of it as an event planning opportunity, like other event planning opportunities throughout our lives with all the milestones that we have. If you're well, a project of this sort can be, it just can be infused with individuality and even creativity. There are lots of facets to consider. So I hate for it to be overwhelming, but if you really sit down and think about it, there are a lot of decisions to be made. So I advise a step-by-step strategy whereby you have a checklist of tasks that can be tackled incrementally. And then little by little, checking off completed objectives signifies progress and makes you feel like you've accomplished something. I don't think you need to feel overwhelmed by the volume of possible matters to tackle. I think the main thing is just get started with something. Determine what's most important for you to be recorded and conveyed. It might be as basic as the method of bodily disposition that you prefer, or maybe the funeral home you'd like used. And then another vital matter to consider, oh my goodness, is the extent to which your affairs are managed digitally. This is something that's emerging as such an important thing to consider. Someone will need to wrap up your affairs once you've died. Now is the time to record passwords and other access information just to avert extreme frustration following your death. Your family will appreciate it so much.
Yeah.
I also recommend having a periodic dire drill akin to an annual fire drill. So rather than practicing an exit plan for a fire, just imagine you have died. Just for one day, imagine you have died and what the scenario will look like. What will your family need? Periodically, at this point in time, when you do this, review your end-of-life declarations and documentation, noting voids that still should be addressed, and then revise according to your current perspectives, maybe based on new information you've acquired. It can be an ongoing project that's just another of a household task to manage, and if that's just part of a regular routine, it's not so sensitive as it might be at the onset.
So one of the things that you also have done is death cafes, and we only have about 4 minutes left. In four minutes, tell us about death cafes.
Well, the Death Cafe was introduced in this country about 12 years ago, and it spread like wildfire. It's just a gathering of people. It sounds like a place, a cafe, but it's really an experience of people coming together to talk about end-of-life matters. It's a place where they're comfortable to share what's on their minds, whereas in the family setting, they might not feel comfortable bringing it up. I began the Rochester Death Cafe 10 years ago, abiding by the rules of the originator, which doesn't allow for any agenda. It has to be spontaneously directed by people within the group based on whatever's on their minds. And then during the pandemic, when the Zoom rooms, rather than in-person gatherings, became the norm, I started collaborating with a Cape Cod Death Educator, and we did online sessions together. And at some point we realized we kind of like the freedom of being able to have speakers or use springboard resources like articles in order to get a discussion going. And so we kind of changed the name for our group to Dust Dialogue. But it's the same thing. They proceed just like they do as if you're adhering to the Death Cafe rules. I can't summarize the topics we've covered because they're so expansive, but the gamut of end-of-life issues are at the core, and when it comes to death, people's minds go in all sorts of different directions. One topic leads to another. Folks might talk about practical matters such as hospice care or choosing a funeral home and making arrangements for a relative, or more mystical speculations about an afterlife often surface, as well as unexplained occurrences leading up to or following someone's death. So regardless of the issues that surface, they provide food for thought in a milieu of supportive camaraderie, and bonds with other participants are readily formed based on the reality that our inevitable mortality actually can be a tie that binds.
And, you know, this topic is so culture-bound, isn't it, Mary Ellen? When I taught nursing, I had a student once who was from Southeast Asia who told me that one of the practices that everybody did was to make their own coffin when they were middle-aged. That wasn't old, when they were middle-aged. And our society, I think part of it is because of this since particularly World War II, as we built out acute care and thought, oh, we can save everyone. And we would put anybody dying in the bed. You remember this, at the end of the hall in a room with the door shut. It was not a topic that then was discussed. I mean, we have these difficult this difficulty with talking about this topic, and we've got to shift it. We just have to. It is a natural part of living, and I hope that people will listen very carefully to what you've had to say today and start having these conversations, starting with who is your healthcare proxy, and writing this down, an advance directive, your wishes at end of life, without getting too specific. Have the conversation. The conversation's what is important, isn't it? Including your conversation with your loved one about what you want when you die, right? After you die.
And I'd like to direct people to the conversationproject.org. That has all kinds of suggestions. If it feels daunting to connect with family about this topic, it doesn't have to be because there's so much going on in everyday life. You can pick up something that you observe and then sort of relate it to your own situation and just ask family members how they feel about something, or just kind of ease into a discussion about it. So I think there are many ways to tackle this without feeling overwhelmed by the prospect of talking to family about it.
And Mariella Mercant, if somebody would like to reach you, is there a way for them to do so?
Yes, indeed. PonderingLeaves@gmail.com.
PonderingLeaves, LEAVES, @gmail.com. Great.
Because leaves fall in the autumn, and they're beautiful right before they die.
Very lovely. Mariella Mercant, a registered nurse and an independent end-of-life educator. Thank you so much for coming on to Health Center in the Catskills today, Mary Ellen.
It's my pleasure. Nice to talk to you.
Take care.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.